So once you know the five things that are required for a conspiracy, now you know how to break conspiracies. Now I want you to turn a corner. I want you to imagine now the conspiracy that the 12 would have to pull off in order to get the Christian conspiracy to work. Let's play a game of Clue.
Up from the grave he arose, with a mighty triumph o'er his foes. We sing it, but do we really believe it? 20 centuries later, do we have any clues to test whether Jesus really came back to life? A detective investigates on today's Truth in the Test Tube. Homicide detective J. Warner Wallace likes the difficult cases, the cold cases that some of his colleagues consider impossible. Today, let's listen to how he sorts out what the evidence says about whether or not Jesus stayed dead as he speaks on the cold case for the resurrection.
Every account we see in Scripture is from multiple sources with extensive detail. By the way, that's the whole determining factor here. Separating what's possible from what's reasonable. This is often argued as this whole thing is an elaborate lie. Let's talk about that for a second. That means we're talking about conspiracy theory. Now, I can tell you the conspiracies require five things to work. I know because I work these. The first thing you need is the lowest possible number of conspirators. It's much easier for two people to lie than it is for 25 people to lie and hold the lie. You also need the shortest possible time span in which to hold the conspiracy. It's easier to hold a conspiracy for 10 minutes than it is for 10 years. Does that make sense? You need excellent communication between co-conspirators. If I stop this guy and he gets asked, does he have our story together? What'd you tell him? I need to repeat to my guy what you told your guy to hold the conspiracy. You can't pre-plan everything. If I'm going to interview people, I always get into the weeds, the minutia of their story, because I know they planned this much, but I want to know what's going on down here, because I know they didn't pre-plan this. This is where they're going to have problems matching their story. Make sense? The next thing you need, if you get it, is if you've got a strong family relationship between co-conspirators, it's hard to break those because, you know, a mom is not even going to waive her rights to speak to you about her son. That's your baby. The son will rat off the mom, but the mom won't rat off the son. And the last thing you really need is you need some pressure. I got called out maybe 3 or 4 years ago, a case where two guys were involved in a murder. When I got there at the scene, and the guy who was assigned the case says, dude, look at this mess. I said, yeah, we're looking for two guys at least. One guy couldn't do this. Do you have an idea who the first guy is? And he said, I think so. Do you want me to go out and arrest him? I said, no. You think he's going to just tell you who he did it with? Let's put our surveillance team on that guy. If you think you know who he is, we'll watch him for a few days. But here are my rules. When you watch him, stay with him the whole time. See who he's hanging out with. That may be your co-conspirator. But do not, when we take him to jail 4 days from now, do not let him know he was being watched by our surveillance team. Don't let him see you were following him. They go out that night, they find him. He's driving around in the victim's car with one other guy. Probably the right guy, I think. We're in the victim's car. We got a co-conspirator. We're good to go. They follow him for 4 days. They go out. They spend some money. They actually sell the car to a bunch of gangsters in the valley. And so they made a split the team. One team stays with the car. One team stays with these two bad guys. And it's a big hassle. But at the end of it all, we finally take him to jail. 4 or 5 days later, we get him into custody. Now, I know, here's how you have a successful conspiracy. And they've got some things in their advantage. They've only got two people involved. That's as small a conspiracy as you can get. They've only had to hold it for 4 or 5 days. That's not bad. I got to control communication and pressure. So I separate these two guys. I take my time getting there. I wait a couple of hours. I go into the first room with the first guy. And I say, dude, I've been talking to your buddy for the last 2 hours. I hadn't been, but I told him I was. And this guy does not want to go to jail for what he says you did. He's willing to lay you out. And I tell him everything they did for the last 4 days as if his partner told me, when in fact I actually watched it with our surveillance team. He couldn't believe his partner would rat him out that quickly. He was upset. And he gave me about 10%, 20% more. So what do you think I'm going to do next? Go to the other guy. Dude, I've been with your partner for the last 4 hours. He does not want to go to jail for what he says you did. And he's told me, he's willing to work with me, he's given me all the information about you, and I give him everything we watched him do plus the 20%. How many times do you think I need to go back and forth? 3 times. Both of them copped out completely. They're both serving life in jail, no parole. I knew I had to control some things. I had to control the communication, and they couldn't talk to each other. And I had to put pressure on them. So they thought that they were going to be the only one to go. Make sense? So once you know the five things that are required for a conspiracy, now you know how to break conspiracies. And this is what we do when we're conspiracy theories. Okay, now I want you to turn a corner. Instead of these four guys I have on the wall, I want you to imagine now the conspiracy that the 12 would have to pull off in order to get the Christian conspiracy to work, given the five things that are required. Let's play a game of Clue. And instead of having your usual Clue board, we'll go ahead and use the area around where Jesus had his ministry. Put the game pieces on, there'll be the disciples. First thing we got to ask ourselves is, how long do these guys have to hold this conspiracy? How about 60 years? Really? Really? Okay, stop. All you, you know, JFK conspirators, all that stuff, just stop. I mean, do you think it wouldn't be a payday for somebody by now to tell the truth about some of these things? A cultural payday, a book deal, a movie, protection, all the stuff you want. You'd be a cultural hero. No, that's not good. How about this one? Do they have a way to communicate with each other? You don't think this guy who's interrogating Thomas is going to say to him, dude, your partners already gave this up. Tell me the truth. Why would you want to die alone for this lie? Everyone's getting that routine done to them. They're getting beat to death. Terrible pressure, no communication. Who in their right minds want to die for nothing they know is a lie when their partners are being told they're going to get off for it? I think it's ridiculous. That's not a reasonable scenario. And of course, we already talked about motive, right? How motive is by those three things we talked about. And these folks never gave up their testimony. They didn't get rich off of it. They didn't get a lot of girlfriends off of it. They couldn't even control the way they died. Also, if you're going to tell this story and you're going to lie about it, do you really think you're going to make the first observers of the risen Jesus women? It's Mary who sees Jesus first. You think you're going to believe a woman in the first century? If you're making fiction out of this, the first person who should see Jesus should be either Joseph of Arimathea or Nicodemus. Two people who had juice in the culture who people might actually believe. Instead, you're going to say that women saw it? That's just not a good way to go. They would testify in hearings, but they were not considered as reliable as men. But that's who actually saw him. So you just write it out the way it actually occurred. I think this idea that they're lying is certainly possible. It's just not reasonable. Maybe they just saw this as a vision, you know, a hallucination. They wanted Jesus to be alive so badly. I mean, think about the first sightings of Jesus. It's Mary. In these two accounts, she's by herself. Peter sees him. In these two accounts, he's by himself. Peter certainly wanted Jesus to be alive. He made a lot of mistakes with Jesus. He wanted, I'm sure, to make amends for those. But then how about like this guy, Paul? Nobody else on the road to Damascus actually sees this vision except for Paul. But do you think Paul really wanted Jesus to be alive? It gets harder, I think, to explain here. And then you have problems with every other sighting that involves multiple eyewitnesses who see the same thing. Because let's face it, like the people on the road to Emmaus, these disciples, there's more than one person involved in this sighting. I told you last night I had a dream, and in this dream I was driving down Melrose Avenue in a new Viper. And you said red, right? I'm like, yeah. And you were listening to the radio. I said, well, yeah, how'd you know that? And you were listening to Ed Sheeran, right? I said, I'm starting to freak me out, okay? Because I'll tell you something. If you have the same recollection that I have, but no one has group dreams, okay? That's called a memory of something that actually occurred. This is what we have here. We have a number of sightings in which we have more than one person saying the same thing they experienced at the same time. So what do we have here? Group hallucinations? You have the actual woman at the tomb. There's more than one. And then you have smaller group sightings, like when the disciples are at the sea and they see him at the seashore and they run to him. Or you have the disciples who were there without Thomas. Judas is already gone, so you only had 11 minus Thomas. You got 10 here. 10 who saw all this at the same time. And then, of course, when Thomas gets back in the game, he joins the group, and now you have the disciples plus Thomas, so you have 11. Or you have 11 who see him here at the mountaintop in Matthew 28. How about the ascension of Jesus? Got a bunch of people here, same time. And then you have, in 1 Corinthians, Paul, who says, dude, if you don't believe me, there are 500 people who saw Jesus alive at the same time. You can go ask them, okay? So how do you explain these kinds of sightings? It gets a little harder, I think. Also, if you wanted to falsify this, oh, you think you saw Jesus? Let's run back to the tomb and see if his body's in the tomb. But you get back to the tomb and the body's missing on top of it all. Now, that's different. Did somebody steal the body? If they stole it, now we're back to conspiracy theory. A lot of these theories roll back downhill to conspiracy theory because you have to account for the empty tomb. The one thing we all agree, and that minimal facts that Gary Habermas, the empty tomb is one of those minimal facts. So I think in the end, this is why Peter says, hey, we're not making this stuff up. We actually saw it with our own eyes. It's possible that they were mistaken, but it's just not reasonable. And all that matters is what's reasonable. Maybe they were fooled. Maybe somebody was an imposter who said, hey, you know what? We can trick these guys and start a world religion. Do you know who this guy is here? This guy's a con artist. Probably the most famous con artist of all. His name is Charles Ponzi. He started what's known as a Ponzi scheme. The chief rule I've learned from guys who work fraud, who work con artists, is this. If you want to be successful conning somebody, you have to know more about the thing you're trying to con them about than they do. You might entice me to join your stupid business plan if I don't know much about business plans. You got to fool me. That means that in order to con the 12, I have to know more about Jesus than the 12. Now think about that for a second. Who would know more than the 12? It'd have to be somebody from the inner circle, and he'd need help. Why? Because he's got to get that tomb empty. We're back to a conspiracy theory. But here's the problem with any imposter. Remember, the risen Jesus after the resurrection is every bit as supernatural as the pre-crucified Jesus. The risen Jesus does all the same stuff that the Jesus did before. So if you're going to be a con artist, you got to be good, because you got to be able to work miracles. You got to be able to appear miraculously in the room. And then you got to be able to ascend into heaven. You got to be good, okay? Everything after the resurrection is every bit as miraculous as before the resurrection. Again, everything rolls back to the empty tomb. Every account we see in Scripture is from multiple sources with extensive detail. They're just telling the truth about the resurrection.
We've been listening to homicide detective J. Warner Wallace presenting the cold case for the resurrection. He was speaking at the Stones Crossing Church in Greenwood, Indiana. We want to thank him and the church for permission to share this abbreviated version with you. To explore Wallace's finding on this and a variety of other subjects in greater depth, we encourage you to check his website, coldcasechristianity.com. That's coldcasechristianity.com. May I make another suggestion? You can check out past and future episodes of Truth in the Test Tube more easily if you bookmark our website here at TWR360. I'm your host, Denny Milgate, inviting you to rejoin us here soon on Truth in the Test Tube.